You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
The recent news from the EU with their AI Act has definitely put them sort of ahead of us as far as, you know, thinking about actual regulations, penalties, you know, what are going to be the costs of you know, doing wrong, you know, quote unquote, within AI.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Caveat, the CyberWire's privacy surveillance law and policy podcast. I'm Dave Bittner, and joining me is my co-host, Ben Yellen, from the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. Hey, Ben.
Hello, Dave.
On today's show, Ben has the story of the NSA purchasing domestic internet data. I've got the story of an interesting pivot from Texas and Florida on their upcoming content moderation case in front of the Supreme Court. And later in the show, my conversation with Josh Hargess. He's the AI security chief for AI security firm Cranium. We're discussing some of the challenges organizations face when trying to build out a roadmap to comply with the EU AI Act. While this show covers legal topics, and Ben is a lawyer, the views expressed do not constitute legal advice. For official legal advice on any of the topics we cover, please contact your attorney. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. All right, Ben, we've got some interesting stories to share this week. You want to kick things off for us here?
Yeah, so I have one that was pretty widely shared over the internet over the last week, and that is about the National Security Agency buying Americans' internet data without warrants. And I'm using an article from the New York Times, although this story really appeared in all news sources.
Yeah.
So you'll never guess which United States senator has been inquiring about the NSA purchasing U.S. persons' internet data.
She, let me guess. Ted Cruz.
Yeah. You know, it would actually not be the least shocking thing for Ted Cruz to be concerned about.
You know, you're right, actually.
If you guessed Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, you are correct.
Okay.
He was bugging the outgoing head of the National Security Agency, Paul Nakasone.
Bugging.
I see what I did there.
NSA joke there, Ben.
I'm all good on the dad jokes.
Yeah.
So he was tormenting the agency. While their outgoing director was on his way out, and there was a scheduled confirmation hearing for the new director. Wyden, using his power as a United States senator to gum the works of the place, decided to put a hold on the nomination until he got an answer to this question about whether the NSA is purchasing logs related to U.S. persons' domestic internet activities. And it turns out, through a letter that was revealed over the past couple of weeks, it was drafted to the Director of National Intelligence, and they CC'd Senator Ron Wyden. Apparently, the NSA is purchasing such data. So the NSA argues that they are only purchasing internet metadata, logs showing when two computers have communicated, but not the content of any message. We know that metadata could be potentially very revealing when you put it in a type of mosaic where you reveal which websites people are visiting, which people, which addresses somebody is emailing with or interacting with on social media.
Right.
That can be very revealing about a person, even if you don't have the content of those conversations. From a legal perspective, obviously, for content, per at least circuit court precedent, you need to have a warrant to access the content of internet traffic, content of emails, basically, or social media posts.
Right. What about metadata?
Metadata, you do not. However, and this is critical, there is a standard to obtain it through a judicially approved process. You don't have to have a traditional warrant, but you have to obtain a subpoena under Section 2703D of the Stored Communications Act.
Huh.
And the standard for that is reasonable suspicion that the metadata is going to be useful in an ongoing investigation.
Okay.
So even though there's not a warrant requirement here, the purchasing of data is still an end around of the otherwise judicially supervised process of obtaining this metadata. And I think that's what's very concerning thematically is what the government cannot obtain through a normal judicial process, whether it's a warrant or a subpoena. They have this end around of just going out and buying the data. Hmm. And I think Congress is right to be concerned about this. I mean, for one thing, Congress controls the purse strings. So it might be incumbent upon Congress to say, hey, you are not authorized to spend money on purchasing U.S. persons' internet traffic unless there's maybe some type of exigent circumstances or unless you obtain a warrant or a subpoena to do so. I think that's something that Congress will certainly consider now that this information has come to light. I think the disturbing thing is that what once required some investigative work and a judicial process and oversight from the executive and the judicial branch, you can just pay to go around all of those requirements. And Americans are already distrustful of the NSA. We've seen that over the last decade as more and more of their activities have been revealed. We went through the Snowden disclosures and reauthorization of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, all of those things. And so I think this just adds to the pile of reasons for U.S. persons to be concerned. You know, it's certainly something that stuck out to me when I saw it.
One of the things that I believe that I saw here, and it's possible I'm mistaken, but that one of the justifications the NSA was using was that our adversaries can get this data the same way. And so they need to be able to do it to be on even footing.
Yeah, I mean, they will say that they do that not just to protect us against terrorism, but to protect us against cyber attacks. Obviously, I think that's legitimate. We do have a significant security interest in protecting our homeland and our virtual space from malign foreign actors. But I don't think you can bypass any type of judicial process just because the bad guys are also able to get their hands on the data. Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine, you know, saying, well, we should just bust into this person's house and see if they have drugs. Because, look, the bad guy is going to bust into that person's house.
Right.
The, you know, the career criminal is going to try and rob somebody and find their stash of weed or whatever.
Yeah.
So I just don't think we should hold ourselves to the standard of if our adversaries are able to do it, we should do it without a prescribed process. I mean, look, these processes are designed to be frustrating. It shouldn't be easy to obtain data that contains so much personal information. There are ways we can balance the security interests with the need to protect individual privacy, but we actually have to go through that balancing process. And I think it's the judicial branch or frankly, you know, administrative law judges and the executive branch, if it comes to that, who should be looking over the facts and making a determination of whether it is in our national security interest to purchase this data and not have this type of purchasing go on off the books, which is what seems to be happening right now.
Remind us the difference with the burden between a warrant and a subpoena.
So to obtain a warrant, you need to show probable cause that either a crime has been committed or is in the process of being committed. So it's just a much higher standard. You can think of probable cause as like 75% sure that this is going to be relevant to a criminal investigation. The standard for a subpoena is much lower. It is reasonable suspicion. In some contexts, it's reasonable articulable suspicion, meaning you can't just have like a vague sense that somebody is committing some type of criminal activity.
I don't like the looks of that guy.
Exactly. It has to be like, right. Well, I have this indicia of data somewhere.
Yeah.
We got a tip from a Mr. So-and-so, so let's purchase this internet traffic and see what we can find. That is the standard. But that is still better than, you know what, I don't have any suspicion at all. Let's just go to these companies, fork down some American tax dollars and obtain this data ourselves, comb through it. You know, once you have all of that data in a database, there is no warrant requirement or subpoena requirement to search that data. So I think that's what makes it particularly dangerous. This is going up against some FTC enforcement actions against private companies who have abused their data collection practices. And, you know, the FTC has cracked down on these private companies. And you know, the government has been caught red-handed, not just the NSA, but other federal government agencies and state and local law enforcement agencies have been caught purchasing this data. So this is really an extension of a broader problem here.
Now, obviously, a warrant that we're talking about oversight from a judge, is it the same with a subpoena? Because I have a vague recollection of, like, police being able to self-issue subpoenas. Is that a thing?
Yeah, it is a thing in some jurisdictions.
Okay.
But there's still, like, a process. It's not the type of arbitrary, we're just going to do it without any oversight.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a level of review, whether it's in the agency itself or from a judge, to obtain that subpoena. So it doesn't require the same type of judicial oversight as probable cause, but it's something. It's some type of standard.
So the reason that NSA would be doing this is one of convenience and maybe velocity here, that is just quicker?
I think it's both of those things.
Yeah.
I think it's quicker because you don't have to have any indicia of reasonable suspicion, which means you don't have to go through the whole documentation process, which is probably very onerous. And then you're just buying a giant haystack worth of data. So just like other mass surveillance programs, you purchase the whole haystack so that you can find the needle in the haystack. So you have that, you know, at NSA headquarters searchable by intelligence community analysts. And you don't have to constantly go back and forth between, in this case, it would be the data brokers themselves who are selling the data or the company that collected the data in the first place. It's kind of streamlining the process so that you can do everything in-house. But, you know, that's great for convenience, but I just think it's not good for protecting personal privacy. I will say there's something illegal about what the NSA is doing right now.
Yeah.
There is no law against purchasing data, even if a subpoena or a warrant would have otherwise been required. So that's incumbent upon Congress. If they are so outraged about this, they could actually take action, as shocking as that sounds, to prohibit this type of activity. And I think that's the effort that Senator Wyden is going to make. And he might get some bipartisan support from it for it from all corners of kind of the civil libertarian-minded members of Congress.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, because I was going to ask you, like, what would NSA have to do to buy this data from the data brokers in the proper way? But they're doing it in the proper way because there's no prohibition against them doing it.
Right. You know, there might be something morally objectionable about it. The NSA has voluntarily discontinued other programs where they had the legal authority, but they got so much pushback that they just stopped doing it.
Mm-hmm.
The one that comes to mind to me is something called Abouts Collection, where for foreign intelligence purposes, they weren't only collecting internet traffic to or from a overseas target, terrorist target, but also any traffic, even if wholly domestic, that was about that target.
Mm.
So if you and I mentioned terrorist X in an email in a wholly domestic online communication, that was eligible for warrantless collection.
Mm.
The NSA got all this pushback about it. And in 2017, they said, you know what? Screw it. It's not worth it's not worth getting angry letters from Ron Wyden every 3 weeks.
Right.
Let's just stop it. They have actually been authorized to resume that type of collection through FISA reauthorizations, but to my knowledge, they have not done so.
Hmm.
So this could be another circumstance where shaming, members of Congress shaming the agency might end up having as much of an impact as actually passing a law, especially if you have an administration that's sensitive to these types of concerns.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what happens next? I mean, are we waiting on Senator Wyden to perhaps put together some legislation, see if he gets support from other senators and so on?
Yeah, so he already has put forward legislation that would prohibit not just the NSA, but all government agencies from purchasing any data that would otherwise require a warrant or a subpoena.
Yeah.
And there have been hearings on this legislation. Like I said, there is bipartisan support for it. The other side of the coin is there's bipartisan opposition.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this a lot. They're kind of, the parties don't neatly align on surveillance issues.
Right.
There's like the Ron Wyden liberal surveillance opponent. Then there's the Rand Paul type of conservative libertarian. Mike Lee in the Senate is another one.
Yeah.
But then you have kind of the, I guess, I don't want to upset anybody here, but there's like the political establishment that's generally more pro-security state.
Mm-hmm.
Think of a Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi, those types of people who've generally been supportive of giving agencies the power to protect us against these foreign threats. Mm-hmm. So
the people who were in office during 9/11.
Exactly. Who went through that trauma. And it's true.
Right. I mean, my laughter is ironic, not dismissive.
Yeah. I mean, it is hard to be in that situation.
Yeah.
Having gone through that with some level of responsibility and not want to do everything possible to prevent it from happening again.
Right.
It's really hard. It's hard to prognosticate about the prospects of something like this going through Congress because it's been such a mixed bag for the civil libertarian coalition to get any sort of substantive anti-surveillance legislation passed that it's really hard to tell. But we'll keep following it, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we will have a link to that story in the show notes. Ben, my story this week comes from the folks over at Lawfare, and they're chiming in on some interesting developments here with the states of Texas and Florida. They've got a case coming up in front of the Supreme Court. This is the Net Choice case, which we've discussed here. Just quick before we jump into the recent pivot here, can you give us a little description of what the Net Choice case is about?
Sure. So these are dueling cases from Texas and Florida. Each of them pass statutes that restrict social media platforms. I think it's subject to a certain threshold.
Mm-hmm.
So really the large platforms from discriminating against certain political content.
Right.
So it's a requirement that they present viewpoint neutrality in whatever their oversight mechanism is for rooting out whatever they want to take down on their website. They can't do so on account of political opinions.
Right. So in other words, Texas and Florida were upset because in their legislators' view, these big social media platforms were being unfairly biased against conservative views on the platforms.
Yeah, now for our conservative listeners, they have a point when it comes to certain subjects.
Mm.
The two most high-profile incidents of this happening, one was the so-called Hunter Biden laptop.
Right.
Which, to get really meta about this, I don't even know what the laptop is about anymore. But it is true that, as it was called at the time, Twitter restricted access to the story for a couple of days because members of the intelligence community and other observers told the Twitter content moderation team, hey, this looks like a Russian operation. You should tread really carefully here. And it turns out it was not a Russian operation. There was a such thing as Hunter Biden's laptop.
Yeah.
I certainly think they had a right to be angry about that. And then the other one is the effort to police disinformation or misinformation as it related to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people who I kind of think are unhealthily obsessed with this. One of them is former data guru Nate Silver.
Oh, yeah.
Who only tweets about content moderation policies related to the so-called lab leak theory.
Right.
I want him to start talking about, statistics again.
Right.
But I can't get my wish. Anyway, the point of that is these social media companies tried to crack down on what public health officials were telling them was misinformation about the COVID-19 pandemic. It turns out a lot of it either wasn't necessarily misinformation or it was something that was the subject of a legitimate dispute. And so I think legislators in Florida and Texas felt particularly aggrieved that they thought their viewpoints were being subject to discrimination by these big tech-controlled social media companies operating out of Silicon Valley.
Yeah. So the platforms, the big social media platforms, sued saying that these laws were a violation of their First Amendment rights. And as you and I have discussed here, that seems right. you are allowed to, as a private company, you're allowed to moderate your platform as you see fit.
Yeah, I mean, I have read all of the legal briefs on it. I am still very dubious about the case that Florida and Texas are trying to make. This seems to me like compelling a private company to platform speech, even if for whatever reason they don't wish to do so.
Mm-hmm.
There's some case law around this. I don't think any of the case law necessarily helps Florida or Texas's case, but we'll see. I mean, it's a new day. They're going to be in front of friendly courts, so it's possible that These cases create a new precedent and a different outcome.
Yeah. So in some of their recent legal briefings, Texas and Florida have pivoted and are trying to make the case that this isn't a First Amendment issue. This is a civil rights issue, that platforms must not discriminate, and they're comparing the discrimination to racial or gender-based discrimination.
I will not swear.
Okay.
But to me, this is horse bleep. Can we just talk about the differences between gender and race-based discrimination versus viewpoint discrimination?
Please.
First of all, one of those is an immutable characteristic.
Right.
You can't change your race or sex.
Right.
You are born that way, in the words of Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
And that applies to other immutable characteristics as well. I mean, certainly there have been arguments about things like sexual orientation and gender identity.
Sure.
That is not true as it relates to your viewpoint. You could always change your viewpoint. A lot of people in history agreed with some things that we would find very objectionable today.
Yeah.
So that's one element of it. The other factor that goes into this is a kind of a history of discrimination and whether whatever group is allegedly being discriminated against doesn't have enough power in our political process. And neither of those factors apply here either. You can make any argument you want. I have a hard time, and I just gave all this credence to these conservative arguments, but I have a hard time believing that there is historical rooted discrimination against political conservatives in free speech cases. Mm. I just personally don't really think there's a strong case to make on that. You're welcome to disagree with me. But certainly they're not politically powerless. And that's kind of the standard that the court looks at when it applies strict scrutiny to these types of classifications, race-based or potentially gender-based classifications. So it just strikes me as a very specious argument. I don't think it's going to be well received by the courts. I think they're using the language of discrimination because it sounds similar. But there are just, to me, very obvious differences between racial and gender and sex discrimination versus viewpoint discrimination.
Yeah. What would happen if they got their way on this? In other words, if this kind of moderation were suddenly categorized as not moderation, but discriminatory in the way that racial discrimination is.
See, I keep thinking about this, and I kind of want to go over the parade of horribles, what this might look like in conservative institutions.
Okay.
So let's say, I wanted to speak at an NRA conference, and my viewpoint was that guns basically should be banned.
Right.
We should have a European-style ban on all handguns.
Okay.
And they told me, you know, I don't want to platform this at our conference. We support Second Amendment rights.
Uh-huh.
Would I be able to sue them for viewpoint discrimination? They're a private company, just the way Twitter and or X and Facebook, et cetera, are private companies. So would that be viewpoint discrimination? I mean, they couldn't discriminate against me on the basis of race because of our civil rights laws. But certainly, I think they have a right to associational rights to choose, you know, who would speak at a conference or represent them or be platformed by them.
Yeah.
Let's say there was, I'm trying to think of all these like more conservative institutions, but like you work for a contractor who does housework. And you have somebody come in who says everything that this company does is environmentally unfriendly, ethically challenged, you know, doesn't align with my views on the importance of federal regulations. Would that company not be able to fire you, even though that went against the mission of the company, which was to be free from burdensome government regulations? I realize these metaphors might seem like a stretch, but I just think that's the Pandora's box we'd be opening if you start to talk about viewpoint discrimination as opposed to discrimination based on immutable characteristics.
Yeah. I'll quote from this article in Lawfare. This is written by Daphne Keller. And in the final paragraph, they write, "The state's 11th hour reinvention as defenders of civil rights is unlikely to fool the court, and it shouldn't steal focus from the real issues in net choice. This really is a case about online expression rules, the editorial rules set by the platform, the ones users might prefer, and the ones states have chosen to impose. It should be decided on that basis.
Yeah, I think that sums it up pretty well.
Yeah. I just find it an odd... I mean, is this the classic case of just throwing everything at the wall when you have a bad hand? So let's see if this works.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I guess it strikes me as being funny that we're all the way to the Supreme Court, and this is the shenanigan we're trying.
Yeah, I mean, look, to an extent, that is what lawyers do all the time. It's like, here, accept this passionate argument I've made. But if you don't accept it,
right,
here are six alternative arguments.
Right,
any
right.
good lawyer is going to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a limit on what I think even a very conservative Supreme Court is going to be willing to accept. And when it comes to this type of viewpoint discrimination being reflected in civil rights laws and precedents, I don't think there's an argument there.
Yeah.
But it's not up to me. It's up to five members of the Supreme Court.
There you go. You don't think they're going to be unanimous in this one, Ben?
You know, as much as I would like them to be on this particular question, not about the whole case, but just on this particular argument.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily see that happening.
No, fair enough. All right, we will have a link to this story in the show notes. And of course, we would love to hear from you. If there's something you'd like us to consider for the show, you can email us. It's caveat@n2k.com. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI. All right. Well, Ben, I recently had the pleasure of speaking with Josh Hargis. He is the AI security chief at an organization called Cranium. And our discussion centers on how the U.S. compares with other regions of the world looking to regulate AI. Here's my conversation with Josh Hargis.
Obviously, AI has been exploding over the past year, mostly due to, generative AI, ChatGPT, large language models, these types of things. But obviously, that's not the only kind of artificial intelligence that's been in development. This has been coming, for the past decade or so. And the U.S., as far as regulation is concerned, has been thinking about this, governance for some time, from the inception of things like the Joint AI Center, which eventually became the Chief Digital AI Office. And then the things like the National Security Commission on AI report that came out. So this is not, taking anybody by huge surprise. The U.S. has been thinking about this. But I will say that the recent news from the EU with their AI Act has definitely put them sort of ahead of us as far as, thinking about actual regulations, penalties, what are going to be the costs of doing wrong, quote unquote, within AI. But, that's kind of the bit of the history and landscape of where we are now.
Can you give us an overview of what exactly is in the EU's AI Act?
Sure. I can give some high-level things. So really what they're most focused on is risk-based. So essentially, what are the high-risk uses of AI? What are some of the lower-risk uses? And really focus on those high risk uses. Some examples there: medical devices, vehicles, influencing elections. Obviously, is a big one. Critical infrastructure. But there's some things that are in there that are a little bit surprising too. Things like education, recruitment, HR, worker management. So there are some things in there that maybe some folks wouldn't consider high risk, but the EU is definitely putting up at the top of the list. And really, you know, obviously, generative AI, in their case, they're calling it general purpose AI, GP AI, is really the focus. And they have a lot of, thoughts around transparency requirements, documentation, copyright safeguards, these kinds of things. And really how they're looking at this is from a very blanketed response. So they want to take sort of an umbrella approach of, you know, thou shalt do these things, thou shalt not do these things, with financial penalties that actually come with that.
Yeah, it's going to be my next question is, to what degree is the EU taking a carrot approach versus a stick approach?
Certainly. So I think, you know, with their guidance, they're trying to roll out a carrot approach. You know, these are the types of things that, you know, we want to see from organizations as far as, AI security, AI assurance, AI governance. And as long as, you know, try to encourage folks to kind of do the right thing. But certainly the stick is large. So up to, I think their latest draft, up to $38 million US dollars, about 7% global turnover, depending on the size of your organization. So quite a large penalty, especially compared to, you know, some of the regulation and penalties that we saw around cybersecurity.
And how does all of this contrast with what we're seeing here in the US?
Yeah, great question. So very different approach so far. So from the US point of view, we're seeing this as more of an agency-driven approach. So essentially, each agency within the US is kind of taking their own approach. There's no centralized organization of this yet. We do have the executive order that did come out. So that's on safe, secure, trustworthy development and use of AI that came out late last year. And that gives kind of an umbrella of sort of guidance of where we think we're headed as far as governance is concerned, but it hasn't given any sort of direct, guidance as far as penalties and things like that. Instead, we're seeing an agency-driven approach. So, for example, the Department of State actually gave its sort of readout of how they want to develop AI and be responsible for AI. They kind of list out their four goals: leverage secure AI infrastructure, foster a culture that embraces AI technology, ensure AI is applied responsibly, innovate. So they're very much more focused on, you know, how do we accelerate what we're doing within our organization, not as much on restricting the use of AI or thinking about governance quite yet. There's other folks, for example, I mentioned them earlier, the Chief Digital AI Office. They have something called the Responsible AI Toolkit that kind of lays out guidelines for how to develop responsible uses of AI. That's within mostly the Department of Defense. And, you know, they have this pyramid that kind of has a hierarchy of needs for AI. But really, you know, nothing quite stick as far as the carrot and stick kind of comparison quite yet. But we do expect to see that coming, probably this year. And then kind of beyond that, I would say what we're going to expect to see from agencies like the FDA, for example, are agency-driven approaches to this type of governance. And they'll probably look towards, you know, things that are coming out of the White House, but then also very much look towards the EU AI Act, just because of the global nature of the development of these systems and the global nature of the economy around this technology.
You know, when it comes to data privacy, it seems like most of the action here in the US has been at the state level. Are we seeing any movement with AI at that level?
Certainly. So California, for example, is leading the way with their own AI regulations. So we should see that roll out early this year. Privacy is definitely, an important part of that, as well as AI governance in general. And I think as that rolls out, that does tend to happen where California will lead the way in some of these areas just by the sheer nature of and the size of the state. So we can imagine, you know, California rolling this out and then some states start to follow suit.
What about for organizations that are multinational? You know, if I'm a big tech company and I'm operating all over the world, is my navigation of this going to be similar to the way that I have to deal with something like GDPR?
Yes, great question. And I think that is the right analogy. So just the fact that this is a global market, if you're a global organization and you have, you know, any citizens in the EU, for example, then you're really going to have to look towards, you know, the strictest regulations that are out there. There, you know, there may be some leeway in some other countries, but, you know, once you're writing your own regulations internal, your own policy and governance internally, you know, just like GDPR, you probably want to take a kind of holistic approach, you know, to that.
Where do you suppose companies stand these days? I mean, when it comes to their attack surface, you know, I feel as though a lot of folks have a good handle on their sort of, I hate to use the word old school, but their old school cybersecurity attack surface. But it feels like AI has thrown in a bunch of new wrinkles.
Yeah, that's correct. We get that question a lot. First level of protection that we're actually hearing the most from organizations is really just, you know, what is in my system? You know, we may have a huge organization with a bunch of data scientists, you know, maybe some business units that are interested in using AI. So really the number one question we get is, you know, what is in my system? You know, is somebody using AI that we're not aware of? What types of AI are being used? And then there's this concern of shadow AI. So, you know, maybe you do have a policy of, you know, thou shall not use ChatGPT in the organization for XYZ. And you're not aware of the fact that somebody may actually be using that.
Right. It's on your phone, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What do you suggest, you know, for organizations who are looking to get a leg up on this? Is there a specific type of technology or talent that they should be pursuing?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So the talent is a difficult one. So we already have a shortage, as most of the listeners on this podcast would know, in cybersecurity. We know we have a shortage there. We have a shortage in AI as a whole, so a talent shortage there. And then when you get to that intersection of folks that know something about AI and cybersecurity, those are kind of how we're viewing unicorns right now. I mean, they really don't exist. There's very few of them. So I think education is a big piece of this, ramping folks up that are on the cybersecurity side on AI technology and vice versa. That's a big part of it. But yeah, I think some of the things that we're seeing and suggesting, you know, really it's that visibility piece first, you know, what's on your system, understanding, you know, vulnerabilities once you do know what's on your system. So mapping things to, for example, MITRE ATLAS, which is a threat matrix developed at MITRE, similar to MITRE ATT&CK, but focused on AI. Things like OWASP, you know, top 10 in machine learning and also large language models. So trying to understand what that threat mapping is from your system to known threats. And then sort of that next piece of compliance. So how do you tell someone else that you're doing the right thing, that you're adhering to, you know, these pieces of governance that are coming out of EU and the US government and different agencies?
Do you see the rest of this year, you know, 2024, as we look at it, do you expect that this is going to be a year of volatility in terms of how people are dealing with AI?
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's a lot of predictions that this is the year of AI, you know, even though we saw a massive explosion last year. And I really think this year is kind of the more mature adoption of AI. So we're going to see kind of two things, in my opinion. I think we're going to see organizations try to mature their pieces of AI in their organization. You know, that includes trying to secure that AI so that they're not susceptible to kind of known attacks. But then the second thing is there is definitely going to be a little bit of volatility in you know, some of these vulnerabilities that are out there. You know, maybe we'll see a big breach this year. You know, we're not quite sure yet, but we haven't seen the kind of breach that's, you know, putting the fear into folks around some of these technologies. And part of that, I believe, is because we're thinking about this ahead of time. You know, this is not the same as the internet era where you know, we really didn't think about cybersecurity until the internet had really reached, you know, sort of everybody's doorstep.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight that, you know, what we've been through with the growth of the internet has led us to be proactive rather than reactive here.
That's right. Exactly.
When we're talking about, you know, technology and the people who are applying it, you know, what about red teaming? How about the folks who are on that side of the fence?
Yeah, good question. So we know red teaming is a very valuable tool, you know, within cybersecurity, also a very valuable tool and methodology within AI. So the idea here is, how can you discover new vulnerabilities within your AI system? And so, you know, we've developed at our time at MITRE, a couple of folks and myself, and then we've continued to work on this at Cranium. But what kinds of talent do you need in that team? How do you stand up that team, whether it's folks with adversarial machine learning backgrounds, cybersecurity backgrounds, you know, pen testing, things like that? Then there's, you know, the execution of red teaming. So, you know, defining objectives, you know, what type of system do you plan to, you know, show this red teaming exercise on, you know, building the attack out, launching that attack, and then finally doing that final impact analysis on the business aspects or the mission aspects. And then sharing those findings out to the broader community and the broader teams. You know, such as a blue team or you know, the rest of the organization doing development. And really what this gives you is, you know, that new, those areas of attack surfaces that you aren't aware of that, you know, maybe currently map to Atlas and OWASP and these other sorts of repositories. And so it becomes a very important tool for really understanding your AI security posture when it comes to these items.
So interesting stuff, Ben. What do you think?
Yeah, very interesting. I've been closely following the EU AI Act. I think we're at like step 50 of 300 and getting this enacted into law. I've had to study how the European Parliament works in order to figure out how this is going to advance. But I do think this is really going to change the industry because companies are going to have to figure out how to comply with this EU law, even in the absence of US legislation. And then you have to worry about the potential conflict, not just with U.S. federal law for compliance, but also with a bunch of state statutes that might be passed in the coming years. So this is definitely something we'll be following going forward.
All right. Well, our thanks to Josh Hargis for joining us. Again, he is a former team lead for the MITRE AI Red Teaming Group, and he is the AI Security Chief for Cranium. We appreciate him taking the time. That is our show. We want to thank all of you for listening. A quick reminder that N2K Strategic Workforce Intelligence optimizes the value of your biggest investment, your people. We make you smarter about your team while making your team smarter. Learn more at n2k.com. Our executive producer is Jennifer Iben. The show is edited by Trey Hester. Our executive editor is Peter Kilpie. I'm Dave Bittner.
And I'm Ben Yellen.
Thanks for listening.